Welcome back to the program. Every hour, 72 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube. The movie and image has become the literature of our time. Perhaps not since the development of movable type has the context of our world and our understanding of it changed so dramatically. But what do we really know and understand about the grammar and structure of visual communication? How are stories and our appreciation of them different when we watch them as opposed to reading them? How will this new realm of visual literacy shape our children, how they see the world, and how they set out to change it? We're going to talk about some of these subjects today with my guest, Stephen Apcon. He is the founder and executive director of the Jacob Burns Film Center, a nonprofit film and education organization in Westchester, New York. He's also the author of a new book entitled The Age of the Image, Redefining Literacy in a World of Screens. Stephen Apcon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
It's good to have you here. When we talk about visual literacy, are we really redefining a kind of literacy, or are we simply adding this to the kind of literacy that we have today, whether it is audio or print or whatever? Visual is a new element, but we're not necessarily redefining it, are we?
It's a great place to start, actually, to start the conversation. So I believe that literacy actually evolves, and as new forms of communication emerge, so too does literacy follow it. So I think that you're right. In some sense, we're talking about a natural evolution, and in some sense we're talking about redefinition, because images play upon our brains, and the kind of grammar that's created around them is very different. So not to hedge my bets, but it's really a little bit of both.
In many ways, we are going back to the future in some respects, because when we think of the earliest forms of communication and think even about cave paintings, that was a form of visual literacy.
Absolutely. I mean, 35,000 years ago, when images were being drawn on caves, as you say, in Chauvet and other places, and we still can see them, that was communication. It was telling stories, but it was also conveying information. And I think what we need to understand is that even words, and printed word and text, are technologies. They're technologies that are used to convey how we feel about things and to communicate information. So I believe that technology evolves in response to a basic human need, and that's the need to communicate in as powerful and compelling and emotional way as possible. What we'd ideally like to do is to be able to take somebody, and when we see injustice in the world, or we see beauty, a beautiful landscape or something like that, what we'd like to do is to take somebody and put them into our body, to see what we see, to experience what we experience, to feel what we feel. And we haven't quite figured out a way to do that, so we created language and communication. And there were clear advantages to print text over an oral storytelling tradition. I mean, remember, you know, thousands of years ago, not only did we emerge from cave paintings, but once we had language, the way we communicated was we shared stories sitting around a campfire. And those stories were passed from person to person, from community to community, from generation to generation. Print came along and had some clear advantages as well as some sacrifices. We didn't see nuance. We didn't see facial gesture. We couldn't look into somebody's eyes. And I believe that image making and visual media is a natural progression toward that ideal of unmediated communication.
Why then is there an inherent fear when you put this out there, particularly in the realms of communication, in the realms of education? There is a sense that somehow it is a zero-sum game, that by adding the element of visual literacy, that it will have some impact on other kinds of literacy.
Listen, first of all, visual storytelling is another tool in our toolbox of communication. I chose to write a book, and here we are on radio talking about a book about visual images. In response to your question, though, I think that there's always a great fear of change, and especially when it comes to elements of communication, which are at the core of the way we navigate our life. So it's not this idea of fear of changing technology is not new. In fact, if we go back to 370 BC and Socrates in a dialogue with Phaedrus, written down by his student Plato, he talks about the fear of writing things down, leading to the loss of intelligent discourse. In fact, he has this quote, the living, breathing discourse of a man who knows, of which the written one can be fairly called an image. So he's in fact tying printed text to the idea of images and is holding higher the tradition of oral storytelling.
How does this relate to the fundamental idea, this fundamental difference between receptive literacy and expressive literacy?
Great question. So it becomes very important to teach not just the receptive side of the literacy equation, but the expressive side, because we understand that communication is ultimately a dialogue. It's as important to express ourselves in a powerful and a compelling way as it is to critically understand what somebody's saying. In traditional literacies, we would never teach listening without teaching speaking. We would never teach reading without teaching writing. And here, too, you know, we have been, for the last century, and certainly in our lives, we have been massive consumers of visual media. We've yet been asked to do the expressive side, but all of a sudden there's this amazing confluence of tools with the tools of creation and of distribution. And it's really the first time in the history of man that we can express ourselves in this powerful medium and share it across the world. So the receptive and expressive side are enormously important, what we call critical, the viewing and the doing.
And it's important that we think about it not just in terms of creating the art, creating the medium, but in fact a different way of storytelling.
Yes, it is. It's a language all its own. I'll tell you, there's an interesting story. And remember, this is a language that is that's 100 years old. Yes, you have images going back to Chavez 35,000 years ago. And in fact, when you look at those images of bisons drawn on the walls, you actually see it's almost as if they're drawn by an animator and what you call onion skin. So you can see a series of drawings underneath them, and you can actually see movement. So you could go back that far, but in terms of cinematic language, or the language that we understand, visual storytelling, it's really a century old. And I'll give you a case in point in terms of a grammatical element, and this is a very simple idea. But and we sort of take this for granted. We see an image of in a film or a television program or web video of the outside of a house, and then we have a cut immediately to a living room scene. We understand that has been contextualized, that we are in this neighborhood at this house, and this is what's going on within this house. In 2010, a bunch of academics from the University of Istanbul, as well as a German university, did a study on a community of people in Turkey that had not had access to any visual media. They had seen photographs, so they understood images, but they hadn't been exposed to visual media, to moving images. And they were shown this kind of sequence and couldn't derive any meaning from it. So, and that's just a very small example of the many conventions that we take for granted. We are visually literate in terms of consumers. Now we need to mine that database to be able to express ourselves. And it is a database.
And part of what's happened is that we now have the technology that makes all of this possible at very little barrier to entry.
Yes. No, that's very true. There are so many situations now that you can point to on the web where you have individuals telling their own stories and not waiting for governments or mass media. The idea that you can broadcast yourself is now clearly accepted. As you said, 72 hours of video added each minute to YouTube, and more than 4 billion hours watched each month. Much of that is being seen from around the world and not the United States, and much of that is being put up by individuals.
And of course the debate always is about the quality of that. Are we raising a generation of only Jenna Marbles, essentially?
Right. So let's talk about that. I think I'm actually quite optimistic. If you go back to the origins of movie cameras and cinema, it began with the cinema of spectacle. And you had the great Thomas Edison putting up images of boxing cats. And it was, these were early tools. it's not surprising that that you know you have cat videos dominating lots of the internet with you know these crazy videos having tens of millions of hits. And in fact, I believe there's a new documentary out about our fascination with cat videos. But I think we need to look past the simplicity and the silliness of some of these things and recognize that, yes, they're capturing our imagination, but they're also giving us the ability to begin to gain some facility with these tools. And there's a lot of highly constructed, very thoughtful, intelligent, literate kinds of things being put up as well. And I believe that that this is a skill that we all need to acquire. Literacy's always been the bar between the haves and the have-nots, and that's going to be true in regards to this kind of literacy as well. So yes, there's lots of cat videos being put up, but I think that there's also an emerging literacy and emerging set of skills that that we all need to acquire.
And as these skills evolve, the question is how they relate to two real key areas of literacy, education being one, democracy being another.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I've spent a lot of time in schools over this past decade working on these issues, and I've had the opportunity to ask so many teachers, what are the goals of education? And, you know, you sometimes get this third goal being, you know, helping people live a self-fulfilling life, but it's not as highly valued because it's not tested, frankly. But aside from the standardized testing, I mean, really the two goals of education have always been how do you create a workforce and how do you create good citizens? So the workforce around the communication skills and the citizens also around communication skills, but around democracy. And I believe that in an era when the way we are increasingly participating in society, engaging in democracy and participating in the global economy is through visual storytelling skills. You had on recently a guest who talked about turning his fourth grade classroom into a situation involving world peace.
John Hunter.
And he talked. He had this great quote, and he talked about finding what the students love in their deepest heart. And I think what he really was talking about was how do you make the classroom relevant to the world our children are growing up in. And there was a great Time magazine article a few years ago that talked about a Rip Van Winkle kind of character who woke up after a deep sleep and was navigating the streets and saw these boxes, you know, rolling down on wheels, and saw computer screens and saw television screens and all of this, and was completely destabilized until he happened to wander into a school, sat down in a classroom, and felt completely comfortable because everything was just the way he remembered it. And what we see time and time again is that kids understand the world through their eyes increasingly today, and it's how they want to express themselves. And when we can meet them with that, we're giving them not only the content, because these kinds of visual storytelling skills can be used in any subject. We're giving them the content, but we're also giving them the kind of 21st century literacy skills that aren't measured by standardized tests necessarily, but I think that most CEOs and most political leaders would tell you are the critical skills for solving problems that are out there today, and that's creativity and problem solving and risk taking and collaboration and communication, cross-cultural understanding and empathy. And those are the kinds of skills that are developed in this kind of literacy. And then there's a third level, which is about leading an examined, a closely observed life, seeing story and seeing narrative in everything that we do. I believe that that is, you know, one of the core essences not only of navigating this world and being gainfully employed and being a fully participating citizen, but also of leading an enriched, meaningful life.
What does research tell us about the way our brains absorb narrative in a visual form as opposed to a written form?
Another great question. 85% of the real estate in our brain is related to video processing, to visual processing, excuse me. And it's very clear that narrative is an important part of it. I had this experience of being able to have my brain studied while I was watching films and in an fMRI machine. And what was fascinating was it was very contrary to what I had imagined. I saw a series of trailers and also a clip of a very emotive film that I remembered from my childhood, Soylent Green, mm-hmm. Charlton Heston, right. and Edward G. Robinson. And then I also saw a piece from something that our students had created around a Chilean social worker. And that piece actually, surprisingly, had the most impact in terms of activating my brain. And I believe the reason for that was that there was a complete narrative in it. And story is ultimately what matters. It connects to this idea of mirror neurons. There's a really brilliant researcher at UCLA, Marco Iacoboni, who wrote a book on mirror neurons. And these mirror, you know, when we see an image, we see an image every 1/24th of a second, which interestingly enough is about the speed of what a typical projector, film projector, runs at. But at each of those images, we have over 100 million neurons that are activated in our brain. Over a million neurons that are activated in our brain. There are about 100 billion neurons within. So it has a very unique footprint or fingerprint with each image. Now, some of those neurons that are activated are mirror neurons, which are tied to this idea of empathy. So very different than other texts. When we see somebody being chased in a sea, or we see something that's beautiful, we have the same physiological reactions to seeing the image that we would have if we were actually experiencing it, which I think is one of the clues as to why this is such a compelling form of communication.
What pressure, then, does it create on written literacy to step up its game in some respects to compete with this?
Well, I don't think it needs to compete. I think that it's another form of communication. And again, I chose to write a book about mm-hmm. this. So I think that, and I also believe that being engaged in communication in whatever form makes us better communicators, makes us more literate in other texts as well. So to become a filmmaker, you need to be able to collaborate, which means to listen and speak and create a shared vision and move forward on that. You need to be able to write a script or a treatment. And ultimately, one of the things that we see that's very interesting with students is we'll work with a classroom where they're doing a series on presidential decisions. And they have the choice of writing a term paper or making a film. And invariably, they not only choose to make the film, but they find out that they need to write the term paper in the process of making the film. They spend countless more hours in doing it. They're completely engaged and enriched by it. They're going to primary source material. And they have to express themselves in the vernacular in a text that is demands a lot of them. And I think that they're acquiring a measure of print literacy at the same time. And they're also being engaged in what they do. I'll tell you a great story, Jeff, about a school up in South Burlington, Vermont, and a teacher who had turned an old shop that wasn't being used any longer into a television studio and had his kids engaged in a series of student video competitions. And what he found, not just competitions within their school, but in the larger community. And these students came to him, and they said they needed more time than what they were doing in the class, and they asked if they could come in at lunch. So he arranged to be there for their lunch periods. And then they weren't happy with that, and they wanted to add to that some time after school. So he arranged to be there after school. Now, it ultimately came to the point where he gets a call in the morning, and they're asking whether they could come into school early and get the school opened up so they can do more work. And he can't make that work in his schedule, but he shows up at school, and he finds out that they have essentially broken into school. Now, you tell me how many classrooms that's happening in. And I think it's, you know, tremendously exciting and speaks, you know, very clearly to them.
Is this something that's going to enhance, not always in a positive way, the digital divide that we've often talked about with respect to education?
I think it is if we're not careful. And it's not just about expression, but it's also about consumption. You know, in many ways, images on our television are the last place where we can lie. You know, we can be marketed a series of pharmaceutical products. There are only two companies in the developed world that allow television commercials around pharmaceutical products. We're one of them. And if you closely analyze those things, you know, you may be being told all of the terrible side effects, including potential death of a product, but the images you're seeing are very counter to that. And I think that we need to be careful to make sure that everybody has access to this kind of literacy so there isn't that digital divide.
Because it does set up the danger for more misinformation and more propaganda in many respects.
That's very true, but that's true of any kind of communication, and certainly of something that is so emotionally compelling. And it's not the first time that it would be a problem. I mean, the propaganda of World War II and people like Leni Riefenstahl who used image to really communicate evil. It's there and it's real. What we need to do is we can't limit what's going to be out there, but what we need to do is give people the tools to make more good media in response to that.
What are you seeing in terms of a generational divide?
Well, I think that there is the possibility of a generational divide. It's interesting. You know, my parents remember when before TV. They remember the first TV coming into the neighborhood and all of the excitement about that. So for them, it was a complete novelty. For my generation, and I'm 51. For my generation, the television was an appliance. We only had one screen in the house, but it was always there. We were completely drawn to it, and it was just part of our existence. Now, if I take an inventory of the screens that are in our house, it's actually kind of embarrassing. we're all carrying these screens around with us. We're living with them in an extraordinary way. To our children, they're not only an appliance, they're an appendage. And they understand it in quite a unique way on the expressive side. But the good news is that all of us that are living today have been exposed to so much media. We've populated a very sophisticated database of cinematic grammar. And all we need to do is begin to mine it for the purposes of expression.
We've talked about it in the context of literacy. Talk about it for a moment in the context of art.
Sure. I think that it has become, that visual images have become a very important part of the way we share our hopes and our dreams and our fears and the way we express it in an art form. Marty Scorsese, who wrote a wonderful foreword to the book, started an organization called the World Cinema Foundation, and it's to go around and to preserve this art form, this decaying art form in so many countries, where it's the kind of treasure that belongs in a museum and belongs to be celebrated as art in the same way the kinds of antiquities of other civilizations are celebrated. And I think he's right. I think it's a very important issue.
Will we be giving rise to a generation that really brings new things to film and to visual literacy that we haven't seen before?
Absolutely. It's a constantly evolving language. As I said, it's 100 years old. If you go back and you look at the conventions that have been created over the last decade even, they're different than the kinds of films that were being done in an earlier period. I'll give you one specific example. When we see a film on the internet, like Roni Edry's film Israel Loves Iran, or We Love Iran, that went viral, the reason we understood it and we understood its authenticity was it had the intimacy of a web chat, of a Skype call, of something that we understand. So it places it in context. Or even something like, you know, a political video like the 47% video, which I think, you know, had a very important role in this last presidential election. That also had a certain veracity and certain vernacular based on lots of other images that came before it. Marjorie Garber, the Harvard professor, wrote a wonderful book, Use and Abuse of Literature, and she talks about what literature is and talks about that it needs to have a, it needs to pass a couple of tests, and one is that it relates to previous material or culture, that it's in conversation with other things, and also that it's open to readers' interpretation. And I think we look for the same kinds of things in visual texts. And I do see language evolving, and I think that will continue to evolve.
Stephen Apkon, the book is The Age of the Image, Redefining Literacy in a World of Screens. Stephen, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed being with you today, so thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.